welcome everybody to this talk from sponsored by the Haven Center and the UW Comprehensive Cancer Center's Cancer Health Disparities Initiative. I can say with really great pleasure this is the first time the Haven Center has co-sponsored an event with the medical school and the intellectual and academic community around the medical school. I met Nancy first in the early 1990s. I didn't remember exactly when, but I asked her when she first arrived. 1991 was our best guess. When I was invited to speak on the concept of class and present my framework for a Marxist-inspired class analysis to an NIH conference, I didn't have a clue what the audience would be like and how to frame what I was talking about in a way that would be intelligible. At that gathering, the most exciting thing that happened for me was meeting Nancy at that gathering, who I felt instantly was a kindred spirit sharing the same priorities, but embedded in such a very different kind of academic and intellectual context. Since then, you weren't at Harvard at that point, were you? No. So since then, she has become a professor of society, human development, and health at the Harvard School of Public Health, and is the Associate Director of the Harvard Center for Society and Health, and Co-Director of the Harvard HSPH, that is Harvard School of Public Health, Interdisciplinary Concentration on Women, Gender, and Health. She's a social epidemiologist with a background in biochemistry, philosophy of science, and the history of public health, and as we proclaim on our Haven Center poster, has combined this with 25 years of experience as an activist in issues involving social justice, science, and health. And for those of you who are not familiar with the Haven Center and its central purposes on campus, it is precisely to combine serious social justice activism with equally serious academic scholarship, to see these as different ways of engaging the world and wanting to bring them into intense dialogue. And that is indeed what Nancy Krieger has done throughout her career. Okay, thank you very much.
So I'm honored and really glad to be here to be a visiting scholar at the Haven Center. It's a privilege to be at a center whose mission, according to the website, is, quote, to analyze the sources of inequality and injustice in existing social arrangements, to suggest both practical and utopian alternatives to those arrangements, and to identify and learn from the many social movements seeking progressive social and political change. It's inspiring to read about the life of Jean Havens, after whom the center is named, and to know that the many students, faculty, and staff that are affiliated with the center are seeking, like Havens, to literally make better havens in this world, in which we can all live, love, work, and die, with our humanity cherished and our dignity intact. And second, I'm also delighted to be here at the invitation of Eric Olin Wright. When we invited him, it was a conference that I co-organized back in 91 on class for the NIH, and it was the first such conference ever of its kind. And it was a fascinating gathering, and work has really come out of that, and I can answer questions about that. But that was key, and it was key having Eric there and representing a perspective that absolutely needs to be heard to make a difference in the society. So his work has also, I would just like to add, been inspiring me ever since I first began to get seriously into the question of, so how do you measure this class thing if you care about it in relation to health inequities? So you'll see some of that in this talk today as well. Today in my presentation, my focus is on deep connections between our humanity, the health of our bodies, including minds, which where minds tend to live, and also our body politic. Within the US and globally, we confront huge problems of unjust suffering. To right these wrongs, we need a clear understanding of their causes, and this requires, among other things, drawing on the best of what each of us can offer from our respective disciplines and walks of life. Hence my talk, The Elephants in the Room, Social Justice, Public Health, and Health Inequities. I'm sure many of you know at least one version of the story of the elephants and the six blind men, or alternatively, the elephant in a dark room with six sighted men. The question before each man, and it's always been told with men, is what is it? To answer the question, each feels a different part of the elephant, its trunk, or its ear, or tusk, or leg, or back, or tail, argues that the part that they touched is the essence of the elephant and come to blows over differing views. The key to resolving the conflict, of course, is realizing that first, the elephant is huge, Second, it is all of the above. And third, it nevertheless is not multiple things, but is instead one being, the elephant. In some versions, enlightenment happens. In others, we remain in a dim, fragmented world. I find this story highly relevant to the science of what's called health disparities. In our rich and multidisciplinary field, we study and at times argue about the many types and levels of determinants and their embodiment across the life course. No matter what our focus, however, we are all grappling with at least three, if not only three, multifaceted elephants. Phrased as questions, they become: elephant one, what are health inequities? Elephant two, what are the causes of health inequities? And three, elephant three, who is responsible for health inequities? And what I will contend is that while there may be many partial correct answers to all of these questions, not all answers are equal and some are outright wrong. To make this case, I will first start with a brief historical reminder, since of course we are not the first to debate these issues. Second, I will argue for why we need an analytic rather than descriptive definition of health inequities. And third, I will present several case examples, including some of our new work on current and changing inequities in U.S. premature mortality, to clarify why the science of health inequities is about correct science and not, quote-unquote, politically correct science, as some have charged. Which brings up another sort of elephant relevant to today's meeting, as perfectly captured by this New Yorker cartoon that was published in 2006. If you can't read the heading, it says, "I'm right there in the room and no one even acknowledges me." And here I must note that during the past year or so, I have seen tellingly more references to elephants in the room than I ever had before. Including in this front page photo in the New York Times and a related photo that was in the LA Times of an art exhibit that was also in September 2006, which literally featured a painted elephant in the room, with the challenge being whether visitors could refrain from talking about it. And of course, I am hoping that the elephant's participation was duly approved by all relevant animal protection agencies. Now, we all know that artists pick up and express the zeitgeist of an era. Equally tellingly, the Oxford English Dictionary added the phrase, "the elephant in the room," only very recently, in June 2006, which suggests that in a time when public and political discourse is so full of palaver and spin, when scientific findings are brushed aside because they're unpalatable to those of power, whether about ergonomics or air particulates or emergency contraceptives or global climate change, the list could go on, there is beginning to be a thirst for some honest reckoning. As a part revealed by the November 2006 elections in this country and recent increases in mobilization for the presidential primaries and the upcoming November 2008 election, meaning that it's time to name the elephants, especially if our work is to make any dent in ending health inequities. Not that everyone wants to do so, as made amply clear by this additional New York Times story, which came out shortly before the November 2006 elections. So the first point, perhaps obvious, is that awareness of what I will refer to as social inequalities in health is not exactly new. In fact, it's a bit hard to miss the injurious effects of destitution, degradation, and hard work on health. And descriptions can be found in documents dating back to the earliest known medical texts. One from around 2000 BCE in Egypt during the time of the prosperous Middle Kingdom recounted, quote, "I have seen the metal worker at this task at the mouth of his furnace. His fingers were like the hide of crocodiles. The barber shaves till late in the evening. He strains his arms to fill his belly and works as indefatigably as a bee. The weaver in the workshop is worse off than the woman who must always sit in the house. He bribes the doorkeeper with bread that he may see the light," end quote. The Hippocratic Treatise on Diet, likely written in the 4th century BCE, likewise observed that only a small minority of the Greek population, its vaunted citizens, had the wherewithal to lead healthy life. The vast majority, upwards of 75% of the population, could not, and they were described in the text as, quote, "the mass of people," quote, "who are obliged to work," quote, "who eat and drink what they happen to get," quote, "and so," quote, "who cannot, neglecting all, take care of their health," end quote. These kinds of comments, however, were chiefly asides. What these early texts mainly provided was advice on how to live well, directed to those who could afford to live leisured lives precisely because others did the hard labor allowing them this leisure. Indeed, it would not be for another 2,000 years in the 16th century CE that the question of how work affects health would get a same treatment in European medical texts. It was not until the early 19th century that studies systematically began to explore the links between poverty and health and between slavery and health, and not until the later 19th century that research seriously began to investigate the impact of women's work, whether at home or in the paid labor force, upon women's health. Or another way to put it, when it comes to health inequities, Another trio of elephants that have been around for some time are privilege, property, and power, benefiting those who possess them, typically at the expense of those who do not. They can also distort scientific theory and research. One quick point to note is that for all these slides, I don't hand out my slides, but there is a bibliography that goes along with this talk that Patrick has loaded on the website, so you'll so you'll get reference to anything that I'm referring to. You can go to the website, download, and get all the references that accompany this talk. So jumping now to our own times, during the 20th century, interest in social inequalities and health certainly has waxed and waned, and an almost total amnesia has separated earlier from later bouts of enthusiasm. So it's well worth remembering that in the United States, during the 1920s and 1930s, the topic garnered serious attention of prominent health researchers and also major federal agencies, partly prompting their concerns with an era of sharp debates about eugenics, immigration, and the Great Depression. Consider, for example, the work of Edgar Sidenstricker, the first statistician hired by the U.S. Public Health Services. Trained previously in economics and agriculture, once at the PHS, Sidenstricker became deeply interested in issues of socioeconomic disparities in health. He then published extensively on this topic from 1916 until his death in 1936. His contributions were empirical, methodological, and conceptual, and provide an elegant illustration of how social sciences are essential for understanding population health. Early on in the 1920s, he designed the first U.S. longitudinal population-based study of morbidity conducted in Hagerstown, Maryland. The survey collected got extensive data on households' health status and also economic conditions, in order, in his words, to give, quote, glimpses of what the sanitarian has long wanted to see, a picture of the public health situation as a whole, drawn in proper perspective and painted in true colors, end quote. And as you can see, assisted on this slide by some helpers from Barbara's realm. Next, in the wake of the 1929 stock market crash, Sidenstricker designed and launched a massive federal 10-city study on the health effects of the Depression. His last major empirical project was to initiate the first U.S. National Health Survey. Launched in 1935, it interviewed over 2.5 million persons and is the predecessor of our now National Health Interview Survey. The reams of publications issuing from this study investigated connections between socioeconomic resources and a wide variety of health outcomes, which range from disabling and chronic illness to occupational morbidity to fertility to school attendance and access to medical care. Two such studies, published in the language of the day under the title, quote, Health of the Negro, end quote, powerfully concluded that, quote, low economic status rather than inherent racial characteristics appears to account in large measure for the higher disability rate observed among Negroes, end quote. Sadly, Sidenstricker did not live to see the survey's findings. He died in 1936 at the age of 54 from a cerebral hemorrhage, shortly after having written much of the legislation that became the Social Security Act of 1935. We owe much to Sidenstricker's work. Without it, we would have few clues about the secular changes in the contours of U.S. population health and health disparities, nor would we have the protection that Social Security afforded against penury and old age, which has made all the difference in reducing poverty rates among the elderly in the U.S. But as a scientist, Sidenstricker left us with more than just a treasure trove of findings and methods. He also helped synthesize and spur a way of thinking about society and health that is relevant to this day. In 1933, he published his landmark and still trenchant book, Health and the Environment, which he prepared as a monograph at the behest of President Hoover's Research Committee on Social Trends. This committee was established in December 1929, 2 months after the stock market crash. In this book, Sidenstricker lucidly and systematically reviewed evidence of linkages between health and various components of what he called the quote-unquote environment. These included, in his words, the geographic environment, the urban and rural environment, economic status, the social environment, and the occupational environment. Harkening back to the elephant in our opening tale, Sidenstricker urged words of caution that guide us still, acknowledging the necessity of what he called, quote-unquote, highly specialized inquiries focused on, quote, one specific environmental factor at a time, end quote. He nevertheless warned that this was, quote, a dangerous procedure, because the too cocksure are likely to overlook important factors other than the especial object of study, end quote. He went on to say that, quote, it is for this reason that so broad a concept of the environment has been insisted upon, and the perils of too narrow an outlook upon the complexities of the subject of environment and health have been so persistently emphasized in this monograph, end quote. In other words, we need to think big and small at the same time, to see the details of an elephant's eyelash while not losing sight of the animal as a whole. To accomplish this feat, Siddenstricker urged that students involved in epidemiology and other public health sciences should, quote, be trained not only in the etiology of disease and human pathology, but also the social sciences, end quote, which, three quarters of a century later, is still a major goal. Also sad to say, despite the headway made in the 1930s, investigating links between society and health, research on how societal conditions affect health did not exactly grow at a steady state. Progress is not inevitable. Setbacks and reversals do occur. As the post-World War II Cold War heated up, the topic became suspect, and it was the rare researcher who was politically brave enough to raise the issue. In 1948, for example, C.E.A. Winslow, one of the giants of public health in the first half of the 20th century, gave a keynote address at the American Public Health Association on, quote, poverty and health, end quote. Tellingly, he felt compelled to state that he was neither a communist or a socialist, but nor was he an anarchist who rejected the idea of government, a position he said was not far different from that of, quote, a great many politicians and businessmen and editors who seem to think that government is an evil and should be reduced to its lowest common denominator, end quote. Sound familiar? Castigating conservative opposition to national sickness insurance and to national subsidies for low-rent housing, Winslow instead called for an effective use of societal resources to abolish, quote, needless human suffering, end quote, and urged, quote, those who do agree with me to go forward with hope and courage, end quote, and those who disagree to come up with a better plan. So far, we have little evidence of the latter, given dramatically raising rates of medical costs, uninsurance, and the cost of housing. It was not until the 1960s that the next wave of interest began to build, propelled by the civil rights and other social movements of the time. 2 decades later, there was enough momentum, albeit with some ebbs and flows, that in 1985, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services issued the Secretary's Task Force on Black and Minority Health. It appeared during the Reagan administration's second term, and let's just say the report did not exactly make a big impact, given the lack of political will to address the social and economic issues raised. But it did serve as a touchstone for continued initiatives to bring the issues of health disparities to the attention of the U.S. scientific community and the broader community alike, such that now one of the overarching goals, the two overarching goals of Healthy People 2010, is to eliminate health disparities. The other overarching goal is to improve population health. Now, while it's obvious that we are nowhere near meeting this goal, at least the goal is there. Attention to health disparities is explicit. The unacceptable alternative is to assume health inequities are inevitable. So on that note, let me return to elephant number one, what we even mean by the phrase health inequities. I start by pointing out that in the United States, pretty much uniquely among nations, our official scientific and scientific discourse does not use this term, but instead uses the phrase health disparities. The U.S. lexicon is likewise singularly permeated by notions of quote-unquote population groups and quote-unquote special populations, without any explicit explanation of why certain quote-unquote population subgroups are singled out and considered to be quote-unquote special. One hint, however, is that these quote-unquote special populations, women, children, people of color, the disabled, the elderly, lesbians and gays, the poor, and people in rural areas, include just about everyone other than white, relatively affluent, urban, able-bodied, heterosexual, middle-aged men who are white. So, to make sense of what links these groups, we need to go beyond a purely descriptive definition of health disparities as simply differences in health across various populations, which is what we see in the official phrases. We need instead to name the elephant. That means we need an analytic definition, one which makes sense of what defines the population groups at issue and the reasons for their discordant health status. The key point is that not all differences are equal. Some have no basis in social injustice. Others are stark reflections of such injustice. For example, the fact that men get prostate cancer and women get cervical cancer is a difference, not an injustice. By contrast, who has access to medical care for prevention, screening, and treatment of these cancers is a matter of social policy, priorities, and politics. Difference and inequity are not the same. It is for this reason that the World Health Organization, among others, has clarified that inequities in health are, quote, unnecessary and avoidable, but in addition are also considered unfair and unjust, end quote. Being explicit about health inequity matters. And so as one example on this slide, I offer the analytic definition that we developed at the Dana-Farber-Harvard Cancer Center. And I'll be talking more about this tomorrow. It explicitly clarifies that health disparities, quote, arise from inequities involving singly and in combination adverse working and living conditions and inadequate health care as linked to experiences and policies involving socioeconomic position and discrimination, end quote. The groups specified by this definition are created by unfair and unjust policies and practices that preferentially privilege certain groups economically and socially at the expense of others. A corollary is that unfair social relationships between groups shape characteristics of groups, including their health status. That is, group properties can arise because of relationships between groups as opposed to being somehow, quote unquote, innate. Mistake one for the other, as often happens in health research, and the causal arrows will go in the wrong direction. This is why social relationships are at the crux of Peter Townsend's 1986 article, Why Are the Many Poor? Concerned with the persistent socioeconomic and health inequities of the United Kingdom. In it, he argued, it's not simply that there are rich and poor, rather there are rich because there are poor. Hence, in his words, to achieve health equity, quote, the only long-term remedy is to restrict the power and wealth of the rich, to dismantle the present structures of social privilege, and to build social institutions based on fair allocation of wealth and on social equality, end quote. Now, obviously, that's a tall order, and certainly a far cry from bland statements about, quote, unquote, difference. Agree or not, at least the question is posed. The elephant, assuredly, is in the room. Filling out this grid as we did for breast, cervix, prostate, and colon cancer was revealing. First, the grids dramatically revealed where work has been done and where controversies exist, and above all, where we have no idea if disparities exist because the research isn't there. As shown on this grid for cervical cancer that was prepared by Dr. Sarah Newman and Elizabeth Gardner, it's hard to miss the blank cells once you have a schema that allows you to see them. Can you see in the back clearly? Okay. Second, filling out the grid emphasized connections between diverse domains of inequity and the accumulation of cancer disparities across the continuum. Embodiment matters. Our bodies do not separately parse our lived experiences. It's not as if, say, one day someone is poor, another day a woman, another day Latina, another day heterosexual, another day an immigrant, another day uninsured, and still another day exposed to HPV and ultimately is diagnosed with and dies from invasive cervical cancer. Mix these connections, and we will miss the elephant. On that note, and as prelude to the premature mortality analysis, let me offer four quick examples of why rigorous thinking about social categories employed in population health sciences matters. At issue from an ecosocial perspective that's concerned with pathways of embodiment across the life course, are the domains of inequity considered and both the level and time frame used for measurement. Ask the wrong question or use the wrong measures and we can get wrong answers that can cause serious harm. Accountability and agency, also core themes of ecosocial theory, pertain not only to who and what generates health inequities, but how we as researchers measure and study them. The first set of data on the slide come from a recent study that I conducted based on Kaiser Permanente's Women's Twin Study Examination 2. The twins design allowed us to match tightly on both genetics and early life experiences, whereby we restricted analyses to monozygotic twins who had lived together and shared the same socioeconomic circumstances through at least age 14. We then compared the health status of the twins who were discordant or concordant on first adult household occupational class at the time of the survey, as informed by Eric's measures, and secondly, on educational attainment. As this slide shows, among the monozygotic twins discordant on adult status, the working class twin fared worse. Compared to her professional twin, she had, on average, significantly higher blood pressure and higher LDL cholesterol. By contrast, no such differences were evident for analyses based on educational attainment, which by definition does not capture post-education socioeconomic position. Thinking clearly about class trajectory matters. There are many health studies that measure just education and think they've done the job. Conversely, the second set of data from a study we did on socioeconomic position at age at onset of menopause show the limitations of measuring only adult socioeconomic position. Prior research has suggested there was no socioeconomic gradient in this outcome, but these studies had measured socioeconomic position only at the time of menopause. By adding childhood social class to the mix, we found that women from working class childhoods who remained working class in adulthood were at increased risk of early menopause, itself a risk factor for cardiovascular disease. So once again, use the wrong class measure from the wrong time period, and you get the wrong answer. Bringing these points painfully home is the example of hormone replacement therapy, or now more accurately called hormone therapy. For the past 40 years, it's been touted as being beneficial for women's health, and especially since the 1980s, as a preventive drug to ward off cardiovascular disease. Yet as we all know, in 2002, two randomized clinical trials, the smaller HERS study and the larger Women's Health Initiative, found evidence of no cardiovascular benefit and instead even possibly cardiovascular harm. These trials also reaffirm the already known yet strangely discounted increased risk of breast cancer, with studies dating back to the 1930s providing evidence of estrogen's carcinogenicity. The clinical trials also confirm results of several epidemiologic analyses, which, starting in the 1980s, had begun to caution that the alleged cardiovascular benefits for women detected in the observational studies might be due to confounding, resulting from the greater affluence and overall better health status of women with access to health care and hence prescription to hormone therapy. Proponents of hormone therapy discounted these concerns, arguing that controlling simply for education or studying women who belong to one overall occupational group, such as nurses, was sufficient to address socioeconomic confounding. But as shown by this recent study, among many others, the concerns about socioeconomic confounding were legitimate. As you can see, adjusting for women's lifetime socioeconomic position and not just adult class rendered null the otherwise observed, quote-unquote, protective effect of hormone therapy on cardiovascular risk, while controlling only for adult socioeconomic position implied that there was still some potential benefit. What harm was taken by failing to take class seriously? One answer lies in the burden of iatrogenic breast cancer brought about by uncritical use of hormone therapy. Here it's important to remember that epidemiologic data clearly showed that the absolute risk of breast cancer was higher than that of cardiovascular disease among perimenopausal women, particularly among the great majority who are non-smokers. Thus, recommendations for hormone therapy effectively asked these women to increase their short-term and not inconsiderable risk of breast cancer with the hope of decreasing their long-term risk of cardiovascular disease. Currently, studies conducted in the US, the UK, Australia, and Norway estimate that hormone therapy accounts for somewhere between 10 and 25% of observed cases. In the UK, this has been estimated to translate into an extra 20,000 cases of breast cancer among women ages 50 to 64 in the past decade alone. New results published in the fall of 2006 indicate that between 2002 and 2003, US breast cancer rates fell by 7 to 11%, which is an extraordinary drop, with a spring 2000 study finding that declines in the order of 15% or more were especially evident among types of breast cancer most linked to hormone therapy use, that is, among older women with estrogen receptor-positive tumors. A study published in August 2007, drawing on the new evidence, in turn estimated that between 1995 and 2002, in the U.S., quote, over 127,000 breast cancer cases of diagnosed breast cancers could be related, quote, to the use of the combined estrogen-progestin hormone therapy. And that's saying nothing about hormone therapy use from 1960 to 1995. Class is clearly an important elephant in the room. So is racism. This slide shows results of our study led by Dr. Sarah Mastillo on racial discrimination and risk of preterm delivery. Prompting the study was the inability of major known risk factors to explain the black excess for preterm delivery and new work implicating placental cortisol levels as a possible trigger. Participants belong to the Cardia cohort, which is a national longitudinal study of cardiovascular risk factors among young adults. In its year 7 exam, it included a survey instrument that I developed to measure self-reports of racial discrimination. The instrument and its validation study are freely available at the website listed on the slide. We analyzed birth outcomes among the 152 black and 200 white women who gave birth between the year 7 and the year 10 exam. As shown by Model 1, overall, black women were 2.5 times more likely to have a preterm delivery than white women, which is what you typically find in the literature. In Model 2, we added their data on exposure to racial discrimination, and this reduced the higher risk among the black women down to about 1.7 and indicated a positive linear association between self-reports of racial discrimination and risk of preterm delivery. In Model 3, we controlled for other well-known risk factors for preterm delivery, including income, education, smoking, alcohol, and depression, but we're left with a nearly twofold greater risk for the preterm delivery in the black compared to white population. Model 4 shows the key results, for which we included the data on both racial discrimination and these other risk factors, whose occurrence, of course, is obviously linked by histories of racial inequality. What it shows is that first, there is no longer any black-white difference. The odds ratio dropped to 1.1 and was not statistically significant. And second, the risk of preterm delivery was 2 and 3 times more likely, respectively, among women who reported some and high compared to no discrimination. Hence, contrary to the claims of some right-wing pundits who are funded by several conservative think tanks, studying whether racism harms health is not about being, quote-unquote, politically correct. It's about doing correct science. So on that note, let me turn to the two major examples that I want to present on the social patterning of premature mortality, both of which build on the work of our Public Health Disparities Geocoding Project. On this slide, I list my team members and also support from our project from NIH, the NICHD, and the Office of Behavioral Social Science Research. The purpose of our project was to investigate whether we could use geocoding and area-based socioeconomic measures to overcome the absence of socioeconomic data in most U.S. public health surveillance systems. This is a non-trivial problem and why fully 72% of the 74 tables on health status and determinants in the major federal report, Health United States 2005, still include no socioeconomic data, even as they are stratified by race, ethnicity, and gender. It's also why fully 70% of the 467 Healthy People 2010 objectives lack socioeconomic targets. Clearly, without data on social class, we can neither monitor progress or setbacks in eliminating socioeconomic inequalities in health, let alone ascertain their contribution to racial ethnic health disparities. In brief, what we found after analyzing 18 different area-based socioeconomic measures, single and composite at 3 different geographic levels, the block group, census tract, and zip code, and in relation to a wide range of outcomes, literally from birth to death, among both the total population and also diverse racial ethnic gender groups, what we found was that the census tract poverty measure was the best metric for public health surveillance on grounds of detecting the expected socioeconomic gradients, completeness of data, and ease of interpretation. For those of you who are interested in the detailed methods and findings of our project, I encourage you to visit the website for our Public Health Disparities Geocoding Project Manograph, which is shown on this slide, and all the publications are available for free, as is also 1980, 90, and 2000 census tract poverty data for the full country. The next logical extension of our project was to put health disparities on the map, literally. Specifically, our work at the census tract level had led us to think that it would be useful to refine the usual city analyses of health by neighborhood by bringing in census tract level data into the picture. Turning to our hometown and with the support of the Boston Public Health Commission and colleagues in the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, we set about to find a way to combine socioeconomic and health data within the same map. Only a handful of prior maps have done this, only for much larger geographic areas, such as counties. So to get you oriented, here I show first the map of Boston with the usual geographic detail, including, of course, such landmarks as Fenway Park, the airport, and being provincial, our home base of the Harvard School of Public Health. We also show the boundaries for the city's 16 neighborhoods. This next map shows another aspect of Boston, the poverty rates of its census tracts by neighborhood. The darkest green refers to tracts where 20% or more of the population is below poverty line, which is a federal definition of a poverty area. The lightest green refers to the least impoverished tracts where less than 5% of the population is below poverty. As you can see, some neighborhoods were the neighborhoods you can see the thicker gray lines to make their boundaries. And some neighborhoods show very little variation in poverty rates by census tract. The Fenway is uniformly poor, and Roxbury is nearly so, while some areas are much more heterogeneous, including my own neighborhood of Jamaica Plain. These next two maps allow us to analyze and depict the contribution of census tract poverty to census tract and neighborhood disparities in premature mortality. They're premised on a multi-level framework that allows us to partition observed variation in premature mortality at the neighborhood, census tract, and within census tract levels, and to model this variation as a function of fixed and random effects. As a result, this framework allows for statistical smoothing in the estimation of small area rates, estimation of variance at each of the specified levels, and adjustment for multiple covariates. So what this slide shows are model-based estimates, all age standardized to the year 2000 standard million, of the premature mortality rates by census tract before and after adjustment for census tract poverty. Two findings stand out. First, within Boston's 16 neighborhoods, there's considerable heterogeneity of rates of premature mortality by census tract, which you can see in the figure, this one labeled before. Second, in most cases, adjusting for census tract poverty greatly reduced the observed census tract level variation in premature mortality rates, and that's shown by this change from darker, that's higher rates, to lower, that is lighter or lower premature mortality rates. The approach that we have not only enables routine monitoring of those patterns, but adds a new focus on key areas within neighborhoods, which previously had been invisible within Boston neighborhood reports. More powerfully, this approach gives a new way of showing how these findings translate into people's lives. This map shows the model-based population attributable fraction in relation to census tract poverty, and what that means is the proportion of premature deaths that would not have occurred if residents in every census tract experienced the same age-specific mortality rates as residents of the least impoverished census tracts. And we are sorry to report this excess fraction exceeded 20% for 8 of Boston's 16 neighborhoods and 68% of Boston's 156 census tracts. Moreover, within two of Boston's poorest neighborhoods, Roxbury and North Dorchester, the excess fraction in about half or more of their census tracts reached 25 to 30%. This means that in these areas, for when every 100 deaths among people under age 75, then 25 to 30 of those deaths would not have happened if residents in these census tracts had the same mortality experience as residents in Boston's least impoverished census tracts. This is a shocking statistic, and one not previously reported for any analyses of health disparities within U.S. cities. We've met with the Boston Public Health Commission, the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, and some Boston community groups to discuss how this type of map can be useful to them and to policymakers in terms of getting the resources required to redress these glaring inequities in premature mortality. I was just at one community event where what way that it was phrased by one of the senators from in Massachusetts now who's been working on health inequities for some time is, she said, the simplest slogan to say is, I want to be able to die of old age. What does it take? Which leads to another point, methodologically at least, the multi-level analysis isn't merely interesting, it's practical and potentially powerful, especially given that the U.S., like many other countries, power in part derives from place, given the geographic nature of voting precincts and legislative districts. Indeed, within the U.K., some colleagues of mine recently analyzed trends of premature mortality rates by parliamentary district. What they found was that between 1996 and 1999, despite gains in most areas, improvement was least in areas where, quote, a high proportion of people voted Labour, end quote, and greater in areas where, quote, people generally voted Conservative, end quote, a finding which they pointed out, quote, mirrors trends in income inequality, which has increased throughout the period of the Labour government, end quote, and which certainly got some constituencies asking whether new Labour policies were really doing all that they could to reduce inequities in the UK. This line of research led us to ask a larger question. What are the trends in U.S. socioeconomic inequalities in premature mortality and infant death rates? Here I note that despite their significance as stark metrics of health inequities, no data exists on socioeconomic trends in either of these outcomes since the early 1960s, either overall or by race ethnicity, with studies instead typically starting in 1968 because of many data limitations. Arguably, however, from a public policy and public health perspective, the period from 1960 to 1968 is crucial. Critical changes obviously include the 1964 U.S. Civil Rights Act, the 1965 establishment of Medicare and Medicaid, the consequent desegregation of U.S. medical facilities, the accompanying expansion of U.S. community health centers and maternal and child health programs, and the many other specific policies of federal government that were part of the quote-unquote war on poverty. We accordingly sought out data to analyze rates of premature mortality and infant death among U.S. counties ranked by income level for the period 1960 to 2002, for the total population by geographic region, and also what by W.B. Du Bois in 1904 famously termed the U.S. color line, which divides the racially dominant U.S. white population and U.S. populations of color. We chose age 65 as the cut point for premature mortality, since this age determines eligibility for Social Security and Medicare, and also because average life expectancy of at least age 65 was consistently attained by U.S. black men only in 1995, compared to 1944 for the total U.S. and white population, and 1973 for the black population overall. We extracted the 1968 to 2002 mortality data from public use U.S. compressed mortality files, and then also managed to obtain the U.S. county 1960 to 67 mortality data, which additionally required manually locating and identifying the correct county codes for each of the 3,073 counties. Denominators consisted of the U.S. Census decennial counts and intercensal estimates. As for the socioeconomic data, because of the loss of the computerized 1960 census 100% detail file, and it really is astounding that the 1960 census data could have been lost, but they were, our economic measure was county median family income, chosen because we were able to locate this for 1960 as well as the 1970 through 2000 census. We assigned counties to quintiles of median family income weighted by county population size, and then calculated for each calendar year each quintile's aggregated age-standardized premature mortality rates, death before age 65 using the year 2000 standard million, and also the infant death rate, which is defined as deaths among persons under age 1. We tested our hypotheses about trends in socioeconomic inequities in premature mortality and infant death in several ways using measures of relative risk, absolute difference, changes in slope, and excess fractions of premature deaths. Our a priori hypotheses was that inflection points, that is changes in the slope, would occur in 1965 and 1980 given major federal policy changes during the Kennedy, Johnson, and Reagan administrations. What did we find? This figure basically tells the story, but there is more to come. Between 1960 and 2002 in the U.S. overall, even as premature mortality and infant death rates declined in all county income quintiles, the gap between the lower and highest income quintiles persisted and was relatively greatest for premature mortality in 2000 and barely changed for infant deaths. The greatest progress in reducing these income gaps occurred between 1965 and 1980, especially for U.S. populations of color. Thereafter, the health inequities widened. Overall, between 1960 and 2000, 18% of premature deaths would have been averted had the populations in the bottom four quintiles experienced the same yearly age-specific premature mortality rates as the highest quintile. This excess fraction translates to an estimated 4.9 million lives cut short. This overall picture obscures stark racial ethnic disparities within and across income quintiles, as shown on this slide. The steep decline in rates in the 1965 to 1980 period was especially notable in the populations of color and especially in the two lowest income quintiles. The combined impact of class and color is further underscored by a result showing that between 1960 and 2002, had everyone experienced the same yearly age-specific mortality rates as whites in the highest income county quintile, then 14% of the white premature deaths, but 30% of the premature deaths among populations of color would have been averted. Moreover, our join point analyses, which are about the changes in slope of the line, show that as predicted, significant inflection points demarcated the period between the mid-1960s and the early 1980s, the era of the greatest declines in U.S. premature mortality rates, especially among the U.S. populations of color. Subsequently, as marked by significant inflection points detected between 1982 and 84, the average annual percent change in premature mortality rates dropped to less than half that of the preceding period for all socioeconomic racial ethnic strata except for the white population living in the two highest county income quintiles, whose rate of decline stayed the same or increased. The same pattern was evident for changes in the magnitude of the incident rate ratio and also difference. As for the analyses for the infant death data, we see the same things. Between 1960 and 2002, the infant death rates declined substantially in every county income quintile, overall, and by race ethnicity. Even so, the relative gap in the lowest and highest county income quintile remained virtually unchanged for the total and white population and actually increased for the U.S. populations of color, while the absolute gap only modestly declined. As with premature mortality, the sharpest reductions in absolute rates in the socioeconomic gap occurred between 1965 and 1980. Throughout, infant death rates were markedly higher in each county income quintile among the populations of color compared to the white population. Only in 2002 did the infant death rate among populations of color in the highest county income quintile attain parity with that of whites in the lowest county income quintile. In summary, death is inevitable. Premature mortality is not. What our results show is that with the United States, the burden of premature mortality and infant deaths, while declining, is strongly patterned by income and the color line. Is this surprising? At one level, no. The finding of risk premature mortality increases with economic deprivation and racial inequality obviously is not new. Research documenting these social facts extends back to the late 18th century. That said, what our results newly underscore is that contemporary U.S. inequities are not immutable. They shrunk considerably between 1965 and 1980 and increased or stagnated thereafter. The early trends give grounds for hope. The latter trends augur poorly for the Healthy People 2010 objective of eliminating U.S. socioeconomic and racial ethnic health disparities. The finding of a declining, then increasing gap is unlikely to be an artifact of inaccurate numerator or denominator data. Since 1960, 99% of all U.S. deaths and births have been registered. Moreover, since 1960, the U.S. Census undercount, which disproportionately affects lower-income populations and populations of color, declined considerably, including from about 6.6% in 1960 to 2.8% in 2000 for the black population. And this would tend to reduce, not inflate, estimates of social disparities and mortality. Results are also unlikely to be affected by racial ethnic classification, given the broad groupings employed. Rather, demographic trends should have reduced, lowered the risk of premature mortality among the U.S. populations of color, given the proportional decline in the U.S. African-American population from 92% to 72%, from 1960 to 72% in 2000 of U.S. populations of color, and the corresponding increase in the foreign-born U.S. populations of color and their associated, quote-unquote, healthy immigrant effect. So what could explain the trends? First, rising U.S. per capita gross domestic product likely contributed to the overall decline in premature mortality rates during the full time period. But this rising GDP cannot explain the observed pattern of a diminishment and then increase in the socioeconomic gradient. Nor can the observed trends be explained simply by relative positioning in a social hierarchy, which doesn't account for either the overall falling rates of premature mortality or the shrinking, then widening of the gap. It's also unlikely that purely individual-level behavioral factors can explain the faster and then slower decline in premature mortality among persons in the lower income quintiles, unless an argument can be made that the health promotion efforts in this group were more successful in the earlier versus the later time period, which is dubious. As an alternative explanation, consider two likely major societal determinants of health: economic priorities and civil rights. Likely contributing to the 1965-80 improvements are the positive impacts of the war on poverty and civil rights legislation that expanded economic opportunity and resources and also availability of health services for both poor and populations of color, especially African Americans. Conversely, the subsequent slowdown likely reflects the adverse impact of post-1980 neoliberal and neoconservative policies to quote-unquote roll back the welfare state. Here I mean cutting federal responsibility and funds for public health and anti-poverty programs, opposing affirmative action, blocking rises in the minimum wage, selectively decreasing taxes on the wealthy, coupled with rising medical uninsurance and persistent racial ethnic disparities in the quality of care. There are definitely some more elephants afoot here, starting especially with the Reagan Republicans in 1980, but in all fairness, quite a number of Democratic donkeys have been kicking around as well, since during the 1990s, in their last administration, akin to that of New Labour in the United Kingdom, inequities continued to rise. To summarize, our results refute the view that widening health disparities necessarily accompany improvements in population health, which some people are beginning to argue now in the literature. They also hint at the importance of pursuing policies designed simultaneously to improve population health and reduce health inequities. As our data show, these inequities are neither inevitable or intractable. If addressing social injustice and its embodied health consequences becomes a priority, we can make progress. Otherwise, the inequities will continue to grow. Moreover, as our data illustrate, the point is not quote-unquote race versus quote-unquote class. Both matter, and we need to understand not only how class inequalities harm health within each and every racial ethnic group, but also how racial inequality harms health, including within and across class strata. Powerfully dramatizing these points, the current PBS series, which I hope some of you have caught, on unnatural causes. It started showing on the last Thursday of March, and it's continuing through the third Thursday of April. So this coming Thursday will be the last
it's
one.
It's actually Sundays here.
It's Sundays here, okay. In Boston, on our opening night, over 700 people attended a standing room only premiere screening that was organized by the Boston Public Health Commission, and another 400 would have come if space permitted. I want to emphasize with the disclaimer that I'm one of the scientific advisors to the series and also appear in it, is how powerfully that the show affirms the experiences of those now suffering the brunt of health inequities, breaking through the individualism so rampant in our society, and making clear in the old-fashioned language of the day that the personal is, in fact, political. People's health woes are at once individual and societal. We experience them as the unique individuals we are, within a context of societally structured options and constraints. In my city and many others throughout the U.S., health departments and organizations are holding public events to build on the series' clear message that racism and economic deprivation can harm health and can be challenged and countered. You can see the list of your area's events if you go to the website listed on the slide. And so if we are committed to reducing health disparities, then sitting on the sidelines and watching a circus pass by, whether befalls of government or science, is not an option. And that second photo is the Frank Gehry building at MIT. Obviously, scientific research alone cannot propel policy change. For that, one needs an engaged constituency. It is our professional responsibility and challenge to inform the public dialogue about social determinants of health inequities based on credible, rigorous science. This matters, obviously, not only for health inequities in the U.S., but in the worldwide. In my presentation today, I focus on U.S. health inequities, not because they are the most important, but because I personally have been compelled to focus on links between social justice and public health here in my homeland, the wealthiest and most powerful nation on Earth. Equally important, of course, is the vital work being done around the world on health inequities within and between other nations, including as a consequence of global politics and disregard for profound connections between health and human rights, including here in the U.S. The chains that shackle the leg of this elephant in the zoo have their political counterparts. When it comes to understanding the enormous inequities in morbidity and mortality at a global scale, empire, to use a newly revived word in U.S. political discourse from the right and not just the left, is yet another elephant in the room. Wherever we work, we must be prepared to investigate explicitly how power, property, and privilege, and political priorities drive societal inequities in health, and also the health of our planet. The snows you see here on Mount Kilimanjaro are fast disappearing due to global climate change and political opposition to cooperative planning for environmental sustainability. As Hurricane Katrina so grievously demonstrated, when the levees break, literally or metaphorically, it's all predictable who will be harmed most, the very groups already most burdened by social injustice and poor health. At a time when our one country is spending at least $2 billion a week on one war alone, with total costs estimated to be over $500 billion and climbing, and that's conservative, it's hard to believe that we do not have the resources to eliminate health inequities in the U.S. or in collaboration with other nations globally. This past January, the New York Times read an estimate saying that of the annual $200 billion spent per year, we could cover the cost of getting health insurance for everyone in the U.S. who doesn't have it, preschool education for every child in the U.S., the full budget for cancer research, which, by the way, is $6 billion, also vaccinate all children in the world, at $0.6 billion, mind you, for diphtheria, measles, polio, you name it, tuberculosis. There are different ways to use money. It's about priorities. So on that note, let me turn to one last elephant, Horton, from Dr. Seuss's classic book, Horton Hears a Who. As some of you may recall, the basic story is that Horton hears a cry for help from a speck of dust that passes by. Determined to save whomever the small folk might be on this speck, Horton is taunted by fellow animals from the jungle who are oblivious to the cries of distress that Horton hears. Wondering what to do, Horton, quote, walked, worrying, almost an hour. Should I put the speck down, Horton thought with great alarm. If I do, these small persons may come to great harm. I can't put it down, and I won't. After all, a person's a person, no matter how small, end quote. The other animals, convinced that Horton has lost his mind, then plot to capture the speck and destroy it. They nearly succeed. Desperate, Horton encourages the folk on the speck, whom he learns are called Whos, to speak up. They do, but it's not loud enough. It's only when the mayor of Whoville finds the one little Who, Jojo, who is playing with his yo-yo, rather than yelling, that the tide turns. Once Jojo lets loose his voice, his, quote, one small extra yap, put it over, end quote. and all the other animals heard the hooves and resolved to join Horton in protecting them. This book was published in 1954, 3 months after the U.S. Supreme Court ruling on Brown versus Board of Education, which decreed that racial segregation in schools was illegal. The timing was no accident. Ted Geisel, the actual author, wrote this book as his tribute to the growing civil rights movement. The allegory is obvious. Andrew Main, as many of you know, a new digital animated version of the story of the film was released this past spring, 54 years since 1954, with the lessons as timely as ever. And so when it comes to the science of health inequities, let me now close with the immortal words of Dr. Seuss, which is that each and every one of us has a yap, as well as a lot, to contribute. Thank you.
You are listening to an extended Friday Forum program on WIDE-LP in Madison. We continue now with the concluding part of the program.
We have a half hour for questions. If you want to just call on people yourself.
Sure.
Please.
So I really like your links between thinking about social and economic policy and the health consequences. And I know that RWJ has a commission now that's trying to kind of push this. But I'm wondering what you think the kind of potential of that is, or what the kind of potential positives and potential kind of pitfalls of that kind of approach are, or if there are no pitfalls, if this is just how we should be thinking about
it. I mean, there are. It's interesting. There are a variety of issues. So on the one hand, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is set up through an organization really led by Paula Braveman and then also now David Williams. This commission that's been established to look at the causes of health inequities, although it's now called the Commission for, I think, a Healthier America. And that commission has been set up very deliberately to be bipartisan. They're actually, for example, the panelists on it are bipartisan in scope. The other thing that's been bipartisan is they've hired two Washington public relations lobbying sort of firms. One's Republican, one's Democrat. So they're trying to take a bipartisan approach to get a discussion, at least going forward, to bring out the basic idea that, as David says repeatedly, social policy is health policy. In other words, at a time where we have, for example, even in this current presidential election that's going on right now, the only discussion of health is about health insurance, as if health insurance by itself is the full story of quality access to medical care. But to have it framed, because there is such a problem of the 47 million plus, depending whose estimate you use, of people without adequate access to health insurance in this country, it's a big problem. And I want to be really clear, as a public health person, people do need medical care. If you are sick and you are suffering, you need treatment. That's not the same as preventing disease in the first place, but it's absolutely necessary. All too often, you get this false opposition between public health and medicine in some ways, or somehow dealing with the social determinants of health means that you can just ignore issues around medical care, access, as well as quality, and that's not true. But what is true right now is that, for example, of U.S. federal dollars, every $100 spent, 99 is to medical care and one is to public health. So a little reorganizing of the priorities could be helpful, and that's part of what this commission wants to do. Now, the thing that's really important to state is that they are trying to bring out ideas of links, that you can't just say health policy is what a health department does or even what the Department of Health and Human Services does, that what happens in transportation, in commerce, in labor, in environment, all matters for health. And I think this is very positive. It's absolutely a top-down approach in this particular commission, and the people who are key to this commission understand that these kinds of policy recommendations, just like with the Heckler Report, if there is not a constituency to do something about it, it becomes more words on paper. So there are fears for this, and also the WHO has a Commission on Social Determinants of Health, which will be issuing its report in June. The concern is that there is not an engaged constituency, or constituencies, I should say, that are willing to push forward on what these recommendations are. It becomes yet another book that sits on the shelf. I think that in both cases, because obviously when you have something that's from the WHO, the reports that it can issue have to be in accord with member states, and clearly some member states have certain opinions that are different from others' member states, there are going to be limits on what will be said. But I think then it's also behooves people who are academic experts who are engaged to have a very lively discussion about what the findings are, what the recommendations are, and to find different ways to engage. That's also part of the idea, not completely, but the timing is fortuitous, with unnatural causes at least here in the U.S., being something that can be used to help get more conversations happening that target people, not only engage people not only already concerned about health inequities, but start to make links with others. So you're starting to watch, and how do you bring people that are involved with issues of urban planning and housing together with people that are doing public health, or people that are concerned with what's going on with regard to high incarceration rates and what happens with people who are going into prison, but also when they come back out of prison to communities, and what's going on with economic structures, and how does this end up relating to health of communities? So my hope with these different reports is that they become useful organizing vehicles. They are not meant to be new insights. They are meant to be bringing the work that has been done literally for centuries now, but particularly in the last two decades, to a much larger public discourse. I mean, what's amazing when you look at some of the surveys that have been done of just sort of general public is because of, in particularly in the United States, because of the entrenched individualism, people do not see health inequities. It's people's own personal problems, and they've done bad things. And the impact of lifestyle thinking in this country, with everybody being turned into a consumer rather than a citizen, is just phenomenal. So this is meant to break through that logic, and is meant to, that ideology, and is actually meant to say that when you see things embodied in people, it's within populations, really bringing live what population health is about in part. That's what I think these things can do. By themselves, there'll be more pieces of paper. If people are engaged and start to figure out how to make those links, King County in Seattle has just put forward a new equity and social justice initiative that's putting for the first time equity at the center of every activity of county government. It has to evaluate what their plans are, and not just health equity, other kinds of equity, but also have the departments talking to each other. This sounds like such a simple idea, but for friends, if any of you know people in local government, to have this become an explicit statement of what you have to evaluate the programs that you have are they making things better or worse at an equity scale, is like a new concept. And to actually mandate it, it's not that it's going to quote-unquote change hearts, but there may be differences that actually happen, and who knows, I mean, there may be some improved cardiovascular health thereafter as well. But that's, I think, what these reports can do. So I think that, you know, one can't then just say we can't criticize. For example, I think the Unnatural Causes film, you know, very heavily, and the producers know this, I mean, I've talked with them tons and reviewed episodes and engaged with them as well as I'm in them. They really emphasize the stress hypotheses, and they have much less on other aspects of just actual flat-out material deprivation. But that's okay. Nothing's going to be perfect. So how can you be in the, you know, both an active proponent of major change in the critical or loyal opposition, because you understand the complexities of the data and there's more to health disparities than cortisol levels, which by themselves are complicated to study anyway, and that's okay. So that's what I'm hoping. I mean, I think that the confluence of these three things, at least in this country, the WHO report when it comes out in June, which will probably be completely ignored in this country, the RWJ commission, which will take a bit of time to get its stuff out there, and this film, it just, you start to feel at least that there's a little more public visibility for the issues.
And on PBS, if you add Bill Moyers Now, which is also focusing a lot on inequities and poverty, and David Brancaccio's Now, Bill Moyers Journal, and Barack Obama putting forth a lot of these tough issues on the table now. I was just talking to someone before we started here. I'm pretty concerned about some of the reaction of the public to this, and I think it's very important to get it out on the table. It's very important work that you've been doing and a lot of other people in the room have been doing. And it's time for the discourse, but the commentators are spinning this in a way that is making it bitter and making it, racist, when it's right on target. So I'm not quite sure that the country's ready for it yet.
Well, I think there's different ways to approach that. I mean, I think it depends the where, and I think it depends the how. I think when we, My experience is what I've been seeing with unnatural causes and the screenings that we've had, the organizing around it. There are people who are absolutely eager to talk about this stuff. Or that, for example, when doing the research on racial discrimination in health that I do, find it particularly obviously among people who have been affected, which is a non-trivial part of the population as well, that to actually be asked questions about this is engaging and it matters, and you actually do not find resistance. And finding also that, for example, one study that we have, and I didn't show any of the data for this, was actually being done in a group of low-income workers in the Boston area from 14 different work sites done through two amalgamated unions. And even though these are unionized workers, and about a good chunk of them were white as well as people of color, particularly black and Latino, 20% were below poverty, of which 40% of the workers of color are below poverty, which tells you something about the lack of union power. We had questions in that survey trying to bring together issues of social hazards at work and occupational hazards. So the occupational hazards, for example, around ergonomics, dust fumes, etc. But the social hazards were about sexual harassment at work, racial discrimination, and also workplace abuse. And we also asked questions about how this may spill over into different aspects of home life. And we were first, told by others, not the people themselves affected, that they're not going to want to talk about this. This is too scary, too whatever. In fact, we had an incredible response rate. We had people who were glad to be asked these questions, and it's more like what you actually have with the experience around domestic violence and emergency room visits, which is that no one's ever asked before. There's actually a chance to say something. And so I think the idea of bearing witness and speaking to what are people's experiences of their health and their bodies is a very particular vantage point, because this isn't about an opinion. This is about your health.
Yeah, I'd like to just raise one issue that was triggered by your brief mention of the Townsend perspective, which is not merely that there's inequities in the sense that some people are deprived, but that those who are advantaged by virtue of that. Mm-hmm. Now, when we think of that in simple economic terms, we talk about redistribution. That is, that in order to solve problems of poverty, somebody's going to be a loser. You're going to have to take things away from some. The question is whether that translates into the health issue. That is, does reducing disparity simply mean bringing up the health conditions, improving them for those who are currently disadvantaged, or does it really mean redistribution of health? So that is, there are people with privileged access which they will lose, and therefore their health outcomes will necessarily decline.
But to argue on that point, there's two things to keep in mind. So one is, I'll do the second part first. So the second part first is that what's also shown in a lot of studies that look at, for example, the income relation of health, is that you have a very strong curvilinear relationship. So that basically a difference in, $1,000, if you're talking, if you want to have some measure of just a reasonable measure of health status. Self-rated health is not great, which we can talk about later on. But if you end up with a curvilinear relationship like this, adding a little bit to these people is a big increase in health. Taking a teeny bit of money away from these people is virtually no change in health status. So it's important to realize that when you are doing some redistribution, taking a little bit from here, giving it here, has enormous differences in what the health outcomes and consequences are, and doesn't really materially make those folk that badly off. Second, in the United States, even the most affluent people are not doing so great compared to what they could be if we had more investment in public infrastructure about things that actually are health promoting, comparing the health in our country to health in other countries that are European and industrialized as well. The second thing to remember, though, that's really important, and this is where it's important to, again, bring together the social and the biological, is the time frame. Because precisely because of a life course perspective, precisely because so many things happen intergenerationally, a mom is not well, she has a baby that's high, that preterm delivery, low birth weight, that has health effects, you have transgenerational effects, you can redistribute income pretty fast, health is going to take a long time to catch up. And so I think it's really important to think about which health outcomes really will change quickly. You can do fabulous things very quickly with vaccination rates. And actually, everybody's health gets better if vaccination is made mandatory and paid for in the public school programs as conditions for going to public school. You actually reduce the inequity. It's one of the few health outcomes we've seen really sharp reductions for in child health, is a public policy that mandated it and not just said you had to get vaccinations, but actually pays for the vaccinations. So you can do those kinds of things, and that doesn't take, and you have more people vaccinated, which is better herd immunity, which is lower risk of infectious disease for everybody else. So So there are ways that you can handle that, and that's something you can do very, very quickly. But for example, you know, we've had a period where you want to talk about one outcome that's had a changing class gradient over time has been, say, for example, lung cancer. Because what happened in the early part of the century, 20th, that is, you had smoking more common among professionals, which is still the case in certain countries that are now less, quote-unquote, economically developed, where you'll find people who are more affluent will be the ones more likely to smoke. They have the lung cancer risk. It switched in this country. This switch to become a predominantly working class and predominantly white working class phenomenon was completed by World War II. And so now you see the lung cancer burden predominantly among white working class people. Well, it depends when you cut the time to say where the health inequities were, and that those people's risk of lung cancer is not about to change dramatically. There's some damage that has been sustained, but there's much damage that could be prevented, which wouldn't take anything from anybody. So I think there are ways that one can really engage meaningfully, but you have to also parse it out by health condition. And I think that that's possible to do, but that's where some of the specificities of health. We don't just have a generic one-size-fits-all biology. We actually have to think about the different ways in which different aspects of inequity are shaping our biology, translating into population health. So I think that while there would be some issues about luxuries, in terms of actually the idea of what is healthy and sustainable living, because the other piece to add is the sustainability part. So continued luxury expenditures at the level of what we have in the United States, we know is not sustainable. We have ecologic crisis happen. That's not exactly good for anybody's health, you know, let alone the proverbial flower, polar bear, or otherwise. So I think all these things have to be brought into that discussion. So I actually think that, what I do absolutely agree with is that there's a view that's very common, and this ties back to the commission question even, which is that somehow you're supposed to emphasize especially the socioeconomic gradient. In other words, that you actually, it's not just that there's like the poor and there's some threshold and they're the ones that have bad health and everybody else is fine. There's actually a more of a gradient, so that you know, increasing levels of whether it's education or income are associated with increasingly better health. But as I said, when you really do the income stuff, you get a much more logarithmic curve, like exponential curve like that. And that somehow if we say that, then that will get everybody, quote-unquote, especially, quote-unquote, the middle class, whatever that's defined to buy into this. But it's not, we only want poverty programs, because if it's only poverty programs, then those will be marginalized, no support for them, the tax base won't support it, blah, blah, blah. The problem is people are increasingly recognizing is it can't be either or. Because if you're going to really do something about reducing health inequities, you actually do have to have programs that are geared in a meaningful and holistic way to improve conditions of life for those who are economically deprived. And I think, you know, and there are ways to do that with income distribution. And the question you raised, like in the countries that where there's the least inequities in health in absolute and relative terms, the Nordic countries, there's enormous redistribution. They create as much poverty as we do, but they redistribute income based on their social programs and taxation policies, and actually all of their health is better. There's a hand back here.
I'd like to hear more about what's happening in Boston, Massachusetts with your negotiations with the local and state following your studies of the inequities in the Boston area. What have you suggested, where should they start, and how are they responding to those?
What part of the work with the Massachusetts Department of Health, it's also just all changed because we have new administration now, and therefore more people that are under the Governor Val Patrick. Under the prior Governor Romney, public health had terrible cuts and had real censorship of findings, actually, and not released. So there's one whole piece of work, which is getting the health statistics back in shape, and I've been working with the health department, and they're going to be issuing a report soon that looks at the birth data using our geocoding technique to actually show what are simultaneously the racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic inequities in many different birth outcomes. So it's starting to, like, how do you change the way a health department reports its data? And I've been doing some similar work with that with the Boston Public Health Commission. On the particular maps of premature mortality, there are groups, the REACH groups and some others have taken them up. I'm not sure where those discussions are going to go because these results are still fairly recent, but it's been eye-opening. There's a group, the REACH Elders Project, where I first presented some of these data. They wanted to talk to their commissioner. There's a state commission that got set up to deal with health inequities. It's now moving into an actual position of health inequities within the Department of Health and Human Services. You know, ideas about trying to push for more people being covered by the living wage, because Boston does have a living wage ordinance, but it covers only certain people. If the firm size is too small, they're not covered. Expanding that coverage, also thinking about getting that coverage elsewhere, is one idea. I know that's been touted. So I'm not sure. I mean, there's a variety of different things, but I'd say that the discussions are happening, and now what's happening is in Boston is they're doing now neighborhood showings of unnatural causes. That's just starting, but they're also actually introducing the curriculum into all the public schools. And the idea there is also to start getting conversations between the kids and their parents about what's going on. And it's the kind of thing where, you know, it's not all planned in advance going where that will end up, but it's making these points very clearly, and particularly the ones about premature mortality. This isn't right. And I'm not sure what the solutions are, but this isn't right. And the mayor actually has really put in some effort to issues of health inequity. So I wish I could say more concrete things, but it's more the sense that things are in motion right now.
My question was about Boston also, because I really think that in the end, the local level, because those issues are going to resonate and the mobilized constituencies when you go to a national level, I think diluting the ability to really do something dramatic really happens quite a bit at the local level, I think, because the politicians have to answer to the people really close to them. There's much better chance. That's really encouraging.
But what's also true is not to give up at the federal level, because that can create standards that then can be used by the local levels to argue about. So this really matters, for example, at the federal level, that of the two overarching goals of Healthy People 2010 that David Satcher got in, not only improving health overall, but reducing health inequities. So that gives a framework that you can then argue things locally. So I think it's a, you know, in the U.S. we have this complicated relationship between the local, the in-between, and whatever, whether it's county or whatever your government form is, and the federal. So I think it's keeping the two in mind that matter.
Thinking about the local, I just want to do a pitch for natural causes also. There is a small group here that's been working on organizing. There was an event in March, but we're going to be doing the same kinds of things that you're talking about with communities and schools and kids. And there are a few of us here, so if anybody is interested and wants to get in on that, I'll stick around and get in touch with us.
And they're even to speak on the synergies. When I organized the screening, the pre-screening that was this last October in Boston for it, and had all these different community groups co-sponsor. And part of what they could do as co-sponsors, they could have their tables out there. And a lot of the groups actually hadn't met each other. I mean, just as you had transportation, you know, they're not talking to housing and government. You had the group that was doing environmental justice work not talking to the group that was doing work around lowering risk of preterm delivery. And to actually get these groups meeting each other and talking to each other, it's, again, you can't predict where that will go, but it's about making some of these connections. And I think that that's an important thing to be hopeful about at this time.
I was wondering, what do you identify as key research priorities on the reduction of social inequality?
So I think there's different, it depends on the kinds of research you do. For example, I have colleagues who do work that's in interventions. And they're doing either from policy interventions or more specifically narrowly designed public health interventions. And there's tons of research questions there. And then I do research as a social epidemiologist. So my research questions in part, which may not seem so active except that they can help promote activity, is partly research questions about how you improve monitoring of health inequities so that you even know if things are getting better or worse. I wouldn't want to say that one is, you know, they're both necessary kinds of research, and we bring different kinds of skills to the table to do that. But certainly one thing is making clear, also going beyond in this country, what you often end up with are so many demonstration projects that then have no funding that happens after that. So you've demonstrated something and then nothing happens. And I think that something about thinking about, because what you end up seeing, and you see this a lot with some of the things that involve actually access to treatment and care, is you see research in lieu of doing proper social services and programs. So I think it's also really important to be aware of the trap that sometimes it can be that there's research on something when in fact what needs really be done is given the existing evidence. There's a lot of work that's moving now that's not in the U.S., but beginning to get some attention here on what's called health impact assessment, which is about trying to figure out, and also particularly health equity impact assessment, which is trying to figure out what is the impact of new policies or new programs or new developments that they have to include not only environmental impact statements, which almost never have follow-up to see if anything ever happens or not, but to actually have human health be part of the consideration and equity in that. So I think there are ways to sort of get foot in the door, and to figure out how to do those is a huge thing that could have lots of different kinds of impacts. But then there's very narrow questions, not narrow, but different, like more, way more precise and more quote-unquote controllable questions. There's work that I'm engaged in, which is improving measures to get at people's experiences of racial discrimination. And there's tons of methodologic work that needs to be done there, because simply going on self-report, while important, is not enough, because there are many things that can affect what people report, both what they're able to and as well as what they're willing to report. And so I've been doing some work with some social psychologists to try to move to other kinds of measures that can tap at what might be going on, especially, so there's work there. I mean, so there's like, there's so many different kinds, and I think that it's just important to make sure that different people are doing different of them. Because it's just like there's not one solution only. So I can't give you an easy answer, but I can say that work that is explicit and not just sort of on the side considering this, but has it front and center. How is inequity producing these, in social forms, producing the inequities that we observe in health at the population level? What do we need to study to understand that? What do we need to understand about what does and doesn't work for quote-unquote interventions is important.
We have time, I think, for one more.
I'm wondering if you'd like to comment on sort of this kind of return to the theme that Eric was on, and that is sort of health care versus health, and the fact that we are rated 29th in the world and spend literally twice the amount of money on purchasing that health care than the rest of the world, those that were measured. And sort of the reality that we do what we know needs to be done and spend money on those places, how much improvement.
I mean, I think it's really important to flag that the debate about how to do health insurance in this country is very long and has gone through many very bitter periods. And there was a period in the 1930s with recommendations for a different health system than what we have. Part of it is the old-fashioned phrase of follow the money, and what happened was particularly at that point the medical interests, not the insurance company, because they weren't well mobilized at that point. There were very few of them. And that got transformed in the post-World War II period. I think that it's important to try to expand the policy discourse. Many will say, well, look, we're not Europe. Well, fine, we're not Europe, but there's even variation in what they do in Europe, and they still manage to do way better than us. And what does this mean about having social goods? And I don't know if there's a way around that, because you can say all the evidence you want. Once you say that we're only going to talk about so much and not everything else, you end up with a truncated discussion that becomes, how do you fill in the patches? And we just had an economist present and was just, saying that the issue that's really driving medical costs, particularly for the age 65 and older, is the illegitimate use, or the marginal use, using polite language, of procedures that shouldn't be used because it's profitable. You get a CAT scan machine, you have to do a lot of CAT scans to reimburse the cost of the machine or the MRI or the whatever it is, and becomes reimbursement-oriented. Well, we have a medical system which is reimbursement-oriented. If we did global budgeting, as I pointed out to him, we wouldn't have the same perverse incentives around getting reimbursements. But it's, if you're not going to allow global budgets, which is what they have in the UK and a slightly different way in Canada, but particularly the UK, where you set a budget for the hospital based on who you think is likely to come to the hospital for care, what that should cost, and they can figure it out amongst themselves how they're going to divvy up the budget to take care of people, but not have this thing of going for the reimbursement of what's the best, like, thing that will get them the most, which also can change diagnostic categories and other little perversions of provision of medical care. So I think that it means bringing up these other examples. This is where we can't have our head in the sand and say we only can go with the discourse that we have right now. That's where Michael Moore's film Sicko is helpful. That's where the Moyers thing that's come out recently is very useful. It's like that you need to make for the public discussion and make it clear that this is not, because many people in the U.S. have absolutely no clue. There is such the strong idea that we have the best system ever. And there's many arguments to refute that, and I don't know, other than presenting the evidence and the stories and building the support and changing, there's change in the medical profession, an increasing number. The Physicians for National Health Program have been working for years, and their membership continues to grow. And the fights between physicians and insurance companies are legendary, and it's not fun. What does it make of medical practice? So I wish there were a simple answer, but I would also say that this is where having a long-term perspective does matter, because this has been fought now for, you know, almost a century in almost the same terms in the U.S. So then you have to ask, what are the impediments, the fundamental social impediments, political impediments to getting this discussion? And that has to do with different views as to what a free market economy should be versus a different form of quote-unquote welfare state, to put it in the most simplistic terms, which doesn't do justice to the argument.
Thank you very much. So remember...